Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the Gospel of Luke. In our last segment, we were looking at the parable of the tenants in Luke chapter 20, verses 9 through 19. Jesus' interpretation of that parable and his warning that the stone which the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, of course, Jesus applied that language of Psalm 118:22 to himself. He had said the builders, his enemies, have blundered badly in their construction of God's building, and God himself was going to take corrective action and, in effect, fire them. And now watch out, Jesus declares, as I review for a moment. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. Everyone upon whom it falls will be crushed. By the way, so much, as I often point out, for the liberal, gentle Jesus, that is tough language. Some people need to read the Gospels. A lot of people out there need to get reacquainted with the biblical Jesus, the true historical Jesus, not the myths they have made up about him in their own minds, the plastic Jesus who is anything people need him to be. Well, what Jesus said there didn't go down well with the teachers of the law and the chief priests, the Sadducees that were standing by. They were furious, and they had murder on their minds. The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately. They knew he had spoken this parable against them, but they had, of course, all hands on deck, so to speak. They had the police of the Jewish Senate at their side, but they were afraid of the people because Jesus was popular with them, and they did not want the Jewish people to stone them, a fear they had expressed at an earlier time. Jesus was held in general favor by the common people. So these guys were afraid of a big backlash if they arrested Jesus publicly. They knew the situation could have been incendiary. It could have provoked a riot. And the Romans would have held the elites responsible for disorder. So they had to bite their tongues, and they had to cool their jets against their collective will, because they did not want to risk losing their prestigious places in an ill-timed effort to get rid of Jesus Christ. That tells us something about their motives. Had they known they were doing the right thing in the eyes of God, well, the Jews would have let nothing or anyone dissuade them from their intentions. Their reluctance to interdict Jesus tells us the obvious. The obvious was it was all political on their part. It was all about getting rid of someone who keeps showing them up for what they were and someone they felt was a threat to all they held dear. They had no righteous cause. Their hostility was self-serving. It was in that day. Today there are different players, but it's still the same thing. They had an agenda. His enemies had an agenda then. His enemies have an agenda today. The agenda is not one that honored God in their day, even if they deluded themselves into thinking so. Well, now they set out with public interrogations to try to trap Jesus into saying something imprudent. They want to get him into trouble with Roman authorities by teasing him, as it were, into making claims that they can take to the Romans. Do you know what this guy is saying? Or lure Jesus into statements of a religious nature or a political nature that will alienate him from the Jewish public, or embarrass Jesus by stumping him in public with their gotcha question. Does that sound familiar with American media today? Most of the time, people will ask sincere questions, but I tell you, One's always got to be alert for those who pretend to be sincere but are trying to elicit damaging answers. The media regularly does that in the case of faithful preachers, and that was the case here. Satan always has his servants prime to do just that. And unfortunately, we give them too many good excuses in our imprudence and sometimes our cowardice. In chapter 20, verse 20, we read, "Keeping a close watch on him, they," Jesus' enemies, "sent spies, who pretended to be sincere. They hoped to catch Jesus in something he said, as I said, so that they might hand him over to the power and the authority of the governor." My friends, truth is always the friend of the godly, but the ungodly are no friends of the truth. Remember that. We must never forget that, and we must always ask God for grace to answer prudently, or sometimes not to answer at all when we know what their game is. Jesus here is the paragon of divine wisdom in his answers. The encouraging thing for you and me is, as I've mentioned before, that through his Spirit, that wisdom which he has without measure as the Son of God can be given to us also if we seek it humbly and ask God trustfully for it. James chapter 1, "If anyone lacks wisdom," and we constantly do, "let him ask of God, who gives to all men," believing men is the idea, "without rebuking us or getting down on us for our weakness or our ignorance." There's a story, you perhaps have heard it, of a little boy who was digging a big hole as his father watched. At some point in the process, the little guy ran into a big rock down in the hole he was digging. And he was digging all around it and finally unearthed it enough that it actually could be lifted out of the hole. But not by him. It's too big. Still trying to impress his father, the little guy tugged and pulled and tried to get his arm sufficiently under it and around it to get enough leverage that he could lift it out of the hole. In the process, he became all sweaty and more frustrated. His father finally asked him, "Son, why don't you use all your strength?" "Well, what do you think I'm trying to do, Dad?" responded the exasperated youngster. "No, son, I mean me. Why don't you ask me to help you lift it? It's too much for you alone." My friends, some things you and I are up against require more power, more wisdom, more of everything good than we possess. The wisdom of Jesus is an example for us of the wisdom that God can put in some measure at our disposal if we are smart enough to regularly seek it and not try to impress everybody with our self-sufficiency. Well, in verse 21, now the despicable hypocrisy is obvious as they try to play on the pride of Jesus by flattery, not realizing no such vice was a part of his makeup, and they were not going to be successful in luring him into a moment of bravado. The spies questioned him, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach what is right." We know that, here they appeal to bravado. "You're the kind of man," as I paraphrase slightly, "you don't show partiality. Man, we're impressed. You teach the way of God in accordance with truth. So tell us, we'll respect your answer. Is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar, the Roman emperor, or not?" The good news is that to gain their ends, you notice they were forced to admit publicly the truth about Jesus. The bad news was that they were so wicked that they tried to use the truth for evil ends, to use the admitted righteousness of a man as a way of destroying him. My friends, those who attempt to turn what is good to evil purposes are the lowest of the low. We see them all the time. Well, in verses 23 through 24, our Lord, of course, was not taken in. He read them like a book. He saw through their duplicity, and he said, "Show me a denarius." A denarius was a Roman coin, thought to be worth a day's wages in that time. Jesus asked, "Whose image and inscription are on it?" "Well, Caesar's," they replied. Verse 25, he said to them, Well, here's your answer. Simple. Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Slam dunk. Verse 26, they were unable to trap him in what he had said there in public, and astonished by his answer, they became silent. These people were the smartest, most erudite people among the Jews. His wisdom, however, handcuffed them and left them speechless and amazed at his intellectual dexterity. They could not cope with his wisdom. Do you remember Stephen in the book of Acts when he appeared before the Sanhedrin on trial for his life? Same thing. In a moment, God gave Stephen the wisdom they could not controvert. The same with the unschooled Peter and John in Acts 4 before the prestigious Sanhedrin. It baffled them. How could these unlettered, uneducated men speak in such a way? Well, not that all of them were ready to throw in the towel. Verse 27, the devil is nothing if not persistent in his purposes. His enemies thought they had still another trick question that had probably stumped many a Pharisee, the sectarian rivals of the Sadducees, and they wanted to test Jesus with it. Their idea was to pose this question to embarrass his ignorance. In that way, they wanted to take Jesus down a few notches in the public eye. So some of the Sadducees, who hold that there is no resurrection or afterlife, they came to Jesus with a question. The question was really a situation that posed a problem for those like the Pharisee denomination and Jesus. One thing the Pharisees and Jesus had in common was that they proclaimed the promise of a future resurrection for God's people. Among the common people, the Pharisees had the greatest influence. However, the Sadducees, who didn't believe in angels or spirits or a physical resurrection, they were descendants of the high priestly families. Thus, they were the aristocrats of the Jewish people. They were very liberal theologically, like many we have posing as Christians today, who claim a lot and believe little. And the Sadducees were political and worked hand in hand with the Romans to keep their influence. To them, the Sadducees, the influence of Jesus over the common people was a potential threat. They could not risk him or his followers or both somehow disturbing the peace and letting the Romans get the idea that they couldn't manage things. Better to get rid of Jesus. And on that score, the Sadducees and Pharisees were of one mind, but for somewhat different reasons. The Sadducees more for political concerns, the Pharisees more for religious differences. So in verses 28 through 33, the question they ask of Jesus is a form of logic called reductio ad absurdum, reducing to absurdity in English. But first, a little background information. Under the provisions of the Old Covenant, there was a Levirate, Levir means brother-in-law, law. This law applied to cases where, according to Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 through 6, a brother would die, leaving no male heir to carry on the family name. The surviving brother was obligated by law to marry his sister-in-law for the purpose of producing a male heir. You'll see examples of this practice in Genesis 38, 8 through 10, Ruth chapter 4, verse 1. Now the Sadducees, to show, in their minds, the absurdity of the resurrection doctrine, they pose to Jesus a situation where one brother dies childless. Teacher, they said, here's the deal, I paraphrase slightly. Moses, you remember, wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife, no children, then that man must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now, here's a situation, they said. There were seven brothers. The first one married a woman. He died childless. The second and then the third brother come along and they marry her, all according to the stipulations of the same law. Well, in the same way, seven of them died. And those seven brothers had this widow. They never managed to leave any children. Finally, the woman dies. Now then, they ask, At the resurrection, whose wife will she be, since the seven were married to her? I can imagine them winking at each other and invisibly patting themselves on the back. See what he can do with that. Well, in verses 34 through 38, Jesus exposes the faulty assumptions at two levels. Let me read Jesus' answer, and then we'll expound it a little better. The people of this age marry, and they're given in marriage. That's the way it is in today's world, Jesus says. But those who are considered worthy of taking part in the age to come and in the resurrection of the dead, he affirms that forcefully. What you don't understand is they neither marry nor will be given in marriage, and they can no longer die, for they're like angels. They are God's children, since they are children of the resurrection. But in the account of the burning bush, get this, even Moses showed that the dead rise. How did he do that? For he calls the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for to him all are alive. Jesus said, you've got some faulty assumptions big time going on there, fellas. First of all, you are assuming wrongly that in the next world, all things, including the institution of marriage, that they carry on as they are now. Right there, you're dead wrong. Those who are considered worthy of taking part in the age to come and in the resurrection from the dead, hey, next world, they neither married nor are given in marriage, they can no longer die. They're like angels. They are God's children, since they're children of the resurrection. So that objection to the biblical doctrine of the resurrection is now proved null and void. And, Jesus says, your disbelief in the resurrection is nullified on another ground that you people have totally overlooked. Do you recall the narrative of Moses at the burning bush? You do, don't you? You'll remember that Moses calls the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Did you hear me? Did you hear that? Surely you cannot miss the implication of that address. Moses implies that the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he implies that they're not dead, they're alive. So God is not the God of the dead, but of the living, and all live unto him. By the way, sometimes when folks read their Bibles, they're well-meaning in many cases, but some folks are a little simple-minded when they want explicit proof text for everything. You show me that in the Bible, word for word, show me that's there. That's kind of sad, as well-meaning as they may be, standing on the authority of God's Word, but some folks, don't be one of them, seem incapable of understanding logic, of understanding implications. When it comes to contesting for a theological point of view, well, they are the first to jump up and demand that one produce a text or text that says explicitly the point in contention. Folks, listen to me. Informing our theology from the Scriptures, please don't be simple-minded like that. Listen, look at the implications. I say again, implications. I say again, implications of the text. Put two and two together. Jesus does exactly that in verses 41 through 44. Example, if someone says, I'm moving to the northwest, and I tell them, well, listen, you'd better come with a raincoat. I do not have to explicitly say then that it rains a lot in the northwest. Any intelligent person can infer that from my remark. If someone says, well, my family and I are moving to the northeast, and I say to them, well, you better buy a warm coat and some long johns. Obviously, I do not need to tell them explicitly in so many words that winter temperatures in that part of the country can get pretty chilly. They can logically infer that. I don't have to produce a text that says to them, it gets real cold in the wintertime, usually in the northeast. Well, it's the same way with reading the Scriptures. Don't always expect the Bible in what it teaches us to put every doctrine we hold in explicit black and white language. We use inferential logic, just as the Church Fathers did. And the doctrine of the Trinity is one of those where we use inferential logic. Well, of course, the teachers of the law, they were called scribes. They were generally the Pharisee sect. Well, on that point, they were with Jesus, and they applauded Jesus for what he said about the resurrection. Well said, teacher, well said. They delighted to see their rival sect embarrassed in theological jousting with Jesus. At this point, they pulled in their horns. No one dare ask him any more questions. They came to embarrass him in public. In the end, they were the ones that got embarrassed. Well, now Jesus decides to turn about as fair play in verse 41. Jesus, in effect, says, okay, you guys have had your turn. Now, I want you to answer me. Why is it said that the Messiah is the son of David? I remind you, David himself declares in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, that's the Messiah, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. Jesus says, I'd have you note that David calls his son Lord. But how can he be his son if David calls his son Lord? There, Jesus had them on the horns of a dilemma by inferential logic. What David said in the psalm implied that the Messiah, or the Christ, was indeed the Son of God. So if they denied that, they denied the Scriptures. And if they admitted that, admitted the implications of David's words, they would have to revise all their thinking about the person of the Christ. That they were not about to do. For then they would have to rethink who Jesus really was, given all his signs and wonders, and the unique authority of his teachings. These scribes were really a despicable and hypocritical bunch, as Jesus made clear, and he warns his disciples not to share the public admiration of them or use them as religious models. In verse 45, Jesus says, beware of the teachers of the law. These people like to walk around in flowing robes, indicative of their status. They just love to be greeted in the marketplace, with respect, that is. And they strive to have the most important seats in synagogues and the places of honor at banquets, pride of place. Yet they devour widows' houses and make a show of lengthy prayers in the street corners. These people will be punished severely or receive greater condemnation, as the NASB says. This thing about devouring widows' houses, they did that by legal shenanigans to take advantage of the defenseless to their own enrichment. Reminds me so much of these prosperity preachers that we have today who ply their heretical and despicable trade by inducing poor people to sow their seed, regardless of their poverty. What that really means, what they really want, is these people to reach down deep and to fund their own so-called ministries so God will bless them and to be able to afford a $165 million private jet. These people are deceivers of the worst kind. Nobody in our society would gain any public applause by standing on a street corner and making a long prayer, or prayer of any kind. People would probably walk to the other side of the street to avoid us. Many would take deep offense for violating public space with our religious activities, but Judaism of that day was in an entirely different situation. It was a sign of a deeply religious person, and the longer the prayers, the more that person was credited with laudable piety. Today, in our circles, most of that kind of religious showmanship is confined to our more private settings. But a lot of it still surrounds the activity of prayer in our days. Over the years, I've met some persons who otherwise would make no positive impression upon me as being truly men or women of God, though God alone knows their hearts. But like these teachers of the law, they seem to me to be, and to me thinks the lady doth protest too much when it comes to prayer. They like to go out of their way to present themselves to all their peers as the great champions of prayer, constantly ringing that bell like a fire station, always hectoring people about attending their prayer meetings. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.